We have been studying together Romans 13 and 1 Peter 2 and the two main interpretations of those passages, especially Romans 13. We continue to do that here this morning. We will talk more about it. I need to let you know before we read our passage today that this morning normally at IRBC we allow you to ask the questions following the sermon. You'll still be able to do that, but I will have a question for all of you following the sermon this morning. And I'm going to let you know what it is. You can think about it a while. How many of you are familiar with CHAZ, the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone? Let me see those hands. Is there another? And another. Hands all over the auditorium. All right. Yes. My question will have to do with that this morning. As we've been studying Romans 13, we've been studying from the scriptures, which we will do it again today, and interpreting it through the scriptures. But a silver lining in every cloud, as you can imagine, with my understanding of Romans 13, I have definitely been given quite a pumpkin-sized softball down the middle with this Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone and how that fits into Romans 13. So you all can think about that a while. We'll be addressing that a little bit later, and I'll be asking you this morning how that is going to work out with your interpretation, whatever it is, of Romans 13. This, of course, goes out to many others too. We're thankful for the responses we're getting from sermon audio. A lot more hits, a lot more downloads than we used to get. So these sermons, they go out to many more folks than you hear. Today, we want to read Hosea chapter 8. Hosea chapter 8 is a list of failures of both Judah and Israel. One of them has to do with their failures as far as civil magistrates are concerned. Set the trumpet to your mouth. This is Hosea 8. He shall come like an eagle against the house of the Lord, because they have transgressed my covenant and rebelled against my law. Israel will cry to me, my God, we know you. Israel has rejected the good. The enemy will pursue him. They set up kings, but not by me. They made princes, but I did not acknowledge them. From their silver and gold, they made idols for themselves, that they may be cut off. Your calf is rejected, O Samaria. My anger is aroused against them. How long until they attain to innocence? For from Israel is even this: a workman made it, and it is not God, but the calf of Samaria shall be broken to pieces. They sow the wind and reap the whirlwind. The stalk has no bud. It shall never produce meal. If it should produce, aliens would swallow it up. Israel is swallowed up. Now they are among the Gentiles, like a vessel in which is no pleasure, for they have gone up to Assyria like a wild donkey alone by itself. Ephraim has hired lovers. Yes, though they have hired among the nations, now I will gather them, and they shall sorrow a little because of the burden of the king of princes. Because Ephraim has made many altars for sin, they have become for him altars for sinning. I have written for him the great things of my law, but they were considered a strange thing. For the sacrifices of my offerings, they sacrifice flesh and eat it, but the Lord does not accept them. Now he will remember their iniquity and punish their sins. They shall return to Egypt, for Israel has forgotten his maker and has built temples. Judah has multiplied fortified cities, but I will send fire upon his cities, and it shall devour his palaces. A horrific judgment. God, if you will, producing his evidence for a lawsuit against his very own people, telling them that he will destroy his own people. They have transgressed my covenant, he says in verse 1, and rebelled against my law. And something that would have been surprising to them: set the trumpet to your mouth, he shall come like an eagle against the house of the Lord. God himself directing Israel's enemies to destroy Israel, because They ultimately made God their enemy. Understand this, my friends. For Israel, it was never about the Syrians or the Assyrians or the Babylonians or the Chaldeans or the Egyptians or the Moabites or the Ammonites. They were their temporal enemies, but they only had temporal enemies when they first had made God their enemy. Don't forget it. But look at one of their problems. This has to do with more with us in verse 4. They set up kings, but not by me. They made princes, but I did not acknowledge them. How does that fit into Romans 13? You know, the Romans 13 idea that, hey, whatever is, as far as the civil magistrate is concerned, must be ordained by God, so we can't resist it. How does that work with this comment from Hosea? They set up kings, but not by me. They made princes, but I did not acknowledge them. Now, I can't answer every question here this morning, in part because there's some questions that I just don't know. But I find that an intriguing comment there. They set up princes, but I did not acknowledge them. What are you and I supposed to do with a prince that God doesn't acknowledge? Just something to consider this morning. We're going to address that a little bit later on in our talk here today. First of all, just a little bit of review. We've asked 7 questions. We'll go over these very quickly. 7 questions. Do we have Romans 13 type language addressed to and in other spheres of authority? And we've seen Romans 13 type language addressed in other spheres of authority. Let's turn to Romans 13. You've heard about it so much, you could probably quote it to me better than the Nicene Creed. By the way, you found out you knew more of the Nicene Creed than you thought you did, didn't you? Once you didn't have to read anymore. It's good. It's a good thing. Romans 13. Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God. And the authorities that exist are appointed by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God, and those who resist will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Do you want to be unafraid of the authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For he is God's minister to you for good. But if you do evil, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain, for he is God's minister, an avenger to execute wrath on him who practices evil. Therefore, you must be subject not only because of wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For because of this, you also pay taxes, for they are God's ministers, attending continually to this very thing. Render therefore to all their due, taxes to whom taxes are due, custom to whom customs are due, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. Owe no man anything, except to love one another, for he who loves another has fulfilled the law. For the commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, you shall not covet. And if there is any other commandment, they are all summed up in this saying, namely, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no harm to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law. And we've said that when the civil magistrate properly executes his job by utilizing the sword, and that sword, by the way, is not meant to tickle the enemies of God. It's meant to kill them, that when the civil magistrate executes this role, this job, this ministry, this service, that is an act of love. It's right here in this passage. All the law, and Paul has just mentioned 5 of the 10 commandments, all the law is fulfilled in this: you shall love your neighbor as yourself. That's why Paul quotes it in this passage. And we made the point from verse 6, we pay taxes in order to support the civil magistrate in his role as the executor of justice. That's why we pay taxes. It's very clear. So we asked the first question, do we have Romans 13 type language addressed to and in other spheres of authority? Sounds pretty broad, pretty binding. You know, submit yourselves to the authorities. And we pointed out that yes, we do have that type of language. We have that type of language in Hebrews, addressed to the church. And we have that type of language also in Ephesians and in other places and in 1 Peter, addressed to the family, specifically wives. And we've also made the point, it hardly has to be made, that many of those who are all about Romans 13 submission type submission there suddenly lose their courage, suddenly lose their conviction when it comes to husbands and wives. Oh my word. Anybody know how to shut these things off? Okay, I think I got it done. You know how to do that. Yeah, turn it off, I don't care. Thank you. Thank you. So we asked that question, is there Romans 13 type language addressed to and in other spheres of authority? And we argued that the language of submission and subjection is even stronger in other areas of the Bible, especially 1 Peter and Ephesians, than it is in Romans 13. And yet, those who want to tell us that it's a great sin to exceed the speed limit. Have you ever heard that one? Oh, man. Don't exceed the speed. Oh. Because, you know, that's a civil authority. They'll tell us that. But at the same time, then, when it comes to the family, then all of a sudden they've lost their oomph. That's not quite the same. There's a lot more we could say about that. We asked ourselves the question, do civil authorities have the right to do wrong? And we answered that especially from Spurgeon's comments on Psalm 82. No one has the right to do wrong, civil authority or not. Number three, we asked ourselves, and we've already addressed this morning, is the application of justice a loving activity? And the answer to that, of course it is. Any parent knows this, right? Well, moms and dads, when you administer justice, is that an act of hatred towards your children, or is it an act of love? We asked, number four, to whom is 13 addressed? And we said it's the church at Rome. But we said, to whom does Romans 13 apply? And we said it applies to the civil magistrate every bit as much as it applies to the subjects of the civil magistrate. It applies to both. We asked, number six, does a civil magistrate have a responsibility to obey and enforce the law of God in his capacity as a civil magistrate? Answer to that, of course, is yes. The last thing that Jesus Christ said, all authority is given to me in heaven and earth. He has all authority. Authority over the civil magistrate. Civil magistrate's job to enforce the law of God, not the law of man. And number seven, we ask, what, if any, are the limitations that bind the ecclesiastical authority from speaking to the civil authority? Is there some limitation, is there some area where the pastor is not supposed to speak to the civil magistrate? Nah, this is my area. You can't talk to me, pastor. The answer is no. And we saw that from the greatest man who ever lived up to that point, John the Baptist, according to the testimony of God himself, Jesus Christ. We saw that John the Baptist told Herod off in a very personal matter. When John approached Herod, he wasn't talking about legislative activities. He wasn't talking about tax levels. He wasn't talking about bureaucratic bungling and how to spend the public money. He was talking about something very personal. He was talking about Herod's wickedness in stealing his brother's wife. Yes, the ecclesiastical authority is not limited in any area from speaking about any area of God's law that applies to the civil magistrate, even the personal ones. Well, moving on, we discussed a local congregation who has pretty much is standing by and doing whatever the civil authorities say they can do as far as opening their church again. And I found out this week this same church is apparently, a couple weeks ago they said they weren't going to sing, Now this particular church is saying they will sing, but apparently they haven't lifted the requirement to wear a mask. So I have no idea what that's going to look like or even worse, sound like. Singing through a mask, are you crazy? Anyway, we contrasted that with the account of the pilgrims. That small congregation from Scrooby, England, who was chased from pillar to post. Specifically cited by King James as his desire to destroy them. And he nearly did it. Being chased from place to place, being tormented, being lied to, being robbed. That's what they did to worship. Versus what we see today. Oh, Governor Wolf, please tell us what we're allowed to do. But this all has to do with Romans 13. It does. So, let's move on. We addressed last week a sermon from Dr. Albert Moeller, president of a Southern Baptist seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. And he says this, and this is where we want to take off from today. He says this. Actually, he was preaching on Romans 13. And this was preached very recently in 2020, back in April. He says, but the balance which the Lord himself prescribed is to be maintained. Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. Well, thankfully, we have enough here to know the limit language. Caesar has no right to claim our soul. Caesar has no right to claim worship. Caesar has no right to cause us to deny Christ or the rule of Christ. But Caesar can demand almost anything else. He goes on to say, figuring out the boundary between what is owed Caesar and what is not owed Caesar, figuring out the boundary between worshiping and obeying God by obeying the government, and when one can disobey God by obeying the government, that's a hard thing to figure out. That's much more complex than can be addressed in any message. That's an intriguing comment to me. It's much more complex and can't be addressed in any message. I would hope he would say in this message, because we're out of time or whatever, any message. You hear what he just said? We'll never figure it out. Here's a flash of insight. If we in the church can't figure it out, I promise you, the state authorities, they'll figure it out for us. If we don't know what it is, they'll let us know. You can be sure of it. Well, we addressed that point last week. We'll address it some more today. Now, today, we want to ask this question. When it comes to the commands and demands of the civil magistrates, what constitutes the voice of God? Asked another way, is the voice of the civil magistrate the voice of God? Or is the voice of God the voice of God? Now, you're going to accuse me, probably properly so at this point, of stacking the deck, right? How can I lose that argument? You know, you say the voice of the civil magistrate is the voice of God. I say the voice of God is the voice of God. Let's see now, who's going to win that argument? I think I've already won. But I don't know how else to set it up here today. I don't know how else to do it. And thankfully, we have opportunities for you to ask questions later. So today our message, Romans 13, 1 through 10, our third installment, this Romans 13, 1 through 10, addressed to whom and applied to whom, or the voice of God is actually the voice of God versus the voice of the state is the voice of God. Please don't tell me that there are not plenty of churchmen out there right now preaching today that the voice of the state is the voice of God. Don't tell me they're not saying that, because I know they are. I've seen too many sermons. I've listened to too many. I've seen them again this week. Is that a fair thing to say? Does the Bible actually teach that? When it comes to the demands and demands of civil magistrate, what constitutes the voice of God? In other words, do we already have enough from the Bible to live a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty? Do we have enough from the Bible to do that? Or do we need a constant stream of new directives coming down from the power centers of our civil authorities? Can't live a peaceful, godly life in all godliness and honesty. We need to have the legislature meet and the governor sign new things every day. Let's go back to Albert Mohler. What he says, that Caesar can demand almost anything else. Caesar cannot claim worship, has no right to cause us to deny Christ or the rule of Christ, but Caesar can demand almost anything else. We said last week, he's covered a lot of ground there with that almost, hasn't he? Don't really quite know what's in there in that almost. Well, he goes on to say that this is a hard thing to figure out. Hard to figure out what to do here, but our contention and conclusion has been the opposite. That is, that this is relatively easy to figure out. I'm putting myself in a bad spot there when I say that. This is easy to figure out. But I believe it is. I'm going to demonstrate that here this morning. That's why we continue to address this topic in today's message. The consistent, most popular Romans 13 message is consistent with what, or understanding, is consistent with what Dr. Mohler says, or should I say what he almost says. That is, the only time we may disobey the civil authorities is when they command us to disobey the scriptures, whereas we have been saying that the only time they may command obedience is when the scriptures grant that authority. That's what we've been saying. And we've been saying if the scriptures do not grant the authority to the civil magistrate to command us about anything, then they have no right. It doesn't matter how many guns they have. That's what we've been saying. Can I demonstrate this? Can I support this today? Or have I got myself in a hole that I can't climb out of? We have said that Romans 13 is primarily a limitation on the state, not the subjects of the state. We always read Romans 13 as limiting the subjects. We've said that Romans 13 seriously limits the state. Seriously limits the civil magistrate. We will address two questions today. Do we have an example of a believer disobeying a direct command of a civil magistrate that does no violence to his conscience to obey God? Number one, do we have an example of a believer disobeying a direct command of a civil magistrate that does no violence to his conscience to obey God? And number two, do we have an example of a righteous uprising against a civil magistrate in the Bible? We will then apply our findings to a contemporary situation that has been visited on our nation generally and on the city of Seattle, Washington specifically. We won't get out of this discussion this morning without addressing that particular mess. And a mess it truly is, there in Seattle, Washington. Okay, number one, do we have an example of a believer disobeying a direct command of a civil magistrate that does no violence to his conscience to obey God? Do we have that in the Bible? Before we look at the passage, we want to come back to that problem that I've mentioned before, and that is that in the contemporary church today, how many of you, within the last month, you don't need to raise your hand, we can talk about it during the Q&A time. How many of you within the last month have tried to have a discussion about things of the Bible with someone else and you found out that the person that you've been talking to, been in church for years, is unable to have a discussion about very basic things that are in the Bible? And you learn through your discussion this person is not reading the Bible. Been in church for years, doesn't know what's in the Bible. Did that happen to you within the last month? Turn with me to 1 Kings 1. Did I say 2 Kings 1? 2 Kings 1, sorry. Oh, no, it is 1 Kings 1. Sorry. It's like finding a tool in my toolbox. What's it doing there? No, it is 2. 2 Kings 1. Ah, come on, man. All right. I know it's 1. I know it's Kings. All right. So it starts out with things falling apart pretty badly. Moab rebelling against Israel after the death of Ahab. Ahaziah, who is one of his descendants, he falls through the lattice. He gets hurt, and he wants to find out if he's going to live. Right? And in the end of verse 2, he sends messengers and says, go require of Baal-zebub, the god of Ekron, whether I shall recover from this injury. But the angel of the Lord said to Elijah the Tishbite, arise, go up to meet the messengers of the king of Samaria, and say to them, is it because there's no god in Israel that you are going to inquire of Baal-zebub, the god of Ekron? I'll stop there for just a moment. I want you to see the significance of what Elijah just said. This king, Ahaziah, is not acknowledging the God of Israel. He's only acknowledging the God of the Philistines, Baal-zebub, demon god. Question. Does that mean the God of Israel, the God of the Bible, the creator of the universe, has no authority just because the king of Israel says he has no authority? Not according to Elijah. That means nothing to Elijah. He uses it as a way to challenge the king. What, you don't have a god? You got to go to this demon god? What are you doing? See, the fact that the king, Ahaziah, doesn't recognize God doesn't mean that God's not God. In fact, it means nothing as far as that's concerned. All right, moving on. Now, therefore, thus says the Lord, the God you're not acknowledging, but he's saying it anyway, you shall not come down from the bed to which you have gone up, but you shall surely die. So Elijah departed, and when the messengers returned to him, he said to them, why have you come back? And they said to him, a man came to meet us and said to us, go return to the king who sent you and say to him, thus says the Lord, is it because there is no God in Israel that you are sending us to inquire of Baal-zebub, the god of Ekron? Therefore, you shall not come down from the bed to which you have gone up, but you shall surely die. Then he said to them, this is the king, what kind of man is he? Came up to meet you and told you these words. They answered him, a hairy man wearing a leather belt around his waist, and he said, it is Elijah the Tishbite. Stop there once again, and then we'll get to where we're going here. Once again, we see the word of the Lord coming true and being true, whether or not the messengers believed it or whether or not the king believed it. Meant nothing. You hear this all the time. Well, I don't believe the Bible. I don't believe in God. You know what in the end that means? In terms of reality, absolutely nothing. The king died just like Elijah said he would, according to the word of the Lord. And whether or not the king believed the word of Elijah is meaningless here. But here we go. All right, put your Romans 13 hat on now. The only time, this is the voice of the state is the voice of God now. The voice of the king is the voice of God. Interpretation. Put this on now and see how you would counsel Elijah. Then the king said to him, this is the king now. This isn't junior high magistrate here. Mid-level bureaucrat, this is the king. King sent to him a captain of 50 with his 50 men. So he went up to him, and there he was sitting on the top of the hill. And he spoke to him, man of God, the king has said, come down. Stop there for a minute. Most of you know what's going to happen next. It's not going to end well for 51 people. Stop for a minute. Romans 13. Talk to me. Romans 13 says, the king says, come down. You're the king. Hey, is the king asking Elijah or telling or commanding or demanding Elijah to do any to break God's law on any point? Is there some secret command that Elijah had or some part of the Bible that tells Elijah that he has to stay sitting on top of the hill? I love that the chronicler here, we're in Kings, but it's still the chronicler, if you will, tells us that he was sitting on top of the hill. He wasn't doing like some like really spiritual exercise, you know, witnessing to somebody, or whatever we think is spiritual. And therefore, the king had no authority to interrupt him in his spiritual exercise. There was none of that. He's sitting on top of the hill, hanging out with his servants, possibly. Maybe even cracking a few jokes about the king of Israel. Who knows? He's not doing anything spiritual. And this idea that we only disobey the king if he tells us to do something contrary to God's law is about to get blown up. Because Elijah has something to say to the king. It's going to be delivered very dramatically. Next verse. Verse 9. Man of God, so the king says, come down. So Elijah answered and said to the captain of 50, if I am a man of God, then let fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50 men. And fire came down from heaven and consumed him and his 50. How's that for your Romans 13 interpretation? The voice of the state is the voice of God. Question. When the voice of the state came up against the voice of God, in this instance, how did things work out? Amazingly, it goes on. Who the second dude is, I have no idea. Verse 11. Then he said to him, another captain of 50 with his 50 men, and he answered and said to him, man of God, thus the king has said, come down quickly. So Elijah answered and said to them, if I am a man of God, let fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50 men. And the fire of God came down from heaven and consumed him and his 50. I can never get that second guy. I get the first one. I can't get the second one. What? I get the third guy. Again, he sent a third captain of 50 with his 50 men. And the third captain of 50 went up and said, and he fell on his knees before Elijah and pleaded with him and said to him, man of God, please let my life and the life of these 50 servants be of yours, be precious in your sight. Look, fire has come down from heaven and burned up the first two captains of 50s with their 50s, but let my life now be precious in your sight. Well, the angel of the Lord said to Elijah, go down with him, do not be afraid of him. So he rose and went down with him to the king. Third guy pleaded. First two guys commanded, demanded. You see, here's the problem. Well, I think we have problems with Romans 13. I think we try to interpret it without the rest of the Bible because we don't know what's in the rest of the Bible. So we just try to do it beginning and ending way out of context, Romans 13. And we take the easy way out. And it's really, really nice to do this because, for the most part, we've lived in a mostly Christianized country, and we haven't had problems with the authority of the civil magistrate. Well, now we're having problems, and now we better figure out just what we believe and what authority the civil magistrate really has, and when do we disobey the civil magistrate, and what are the limits of his authority? Well, what happens next? We don't have time to read it, but there's an interesting comment here. They drag Elijah into the discussion. And Elijah says something interesting. He says, you know what? He says to the king of Israel, he said, you know what? I'm only here because Jehoshaphat's here, and Jehoshaphat fears me. I'm only even here because Jehoshaphat is here. If it weren't for Jehoshaphat, I wouldn't acknowledge you. I wouldn't even look at you. Elijah says this right to the king. Question for you today. Just a question. What do we do? This is the same questions I asked from Hosea chapter 8. What do we do with civil magistrates that do not acknowledge God and that God does not acknowledge them? I am not prepared to answer that question entirely today, but it's a question that must be asked because we know from the scriptures that there are civil magistrates that God does not acknowledge. Moving on. Let's go to question number 2. Do we have an example of a righteous uprising against a civil magistrate? Turn with me this time to 2 Chronicles 23. Can I ask you to put on your Romans 13 hat here again? So I have to really start in chapter 22. And verse 10 of 2 Chronicles. Now when Athaliah, the mother of Ahaziah, saw that her son was dead, she arose and destroyed all the royal heirs of the house of Judah. She killed them all. But Jehoshabeath, the daughter of the king, took Joash, the son of Ahaziah, and stole him away from among the king's sons who were being murdered, and put him and his nurse in a bedroom. So Jehoshabeath, the daughter of King Joram, the wife of Jehoiada the priest, for she was a sister of Ahaziah, hid him from Athaliah so that she did not kill him. Backing up here just a little bit, we don't have time to go into it, but this wicked woman, Athaliah, was related to another very wicked woman. If you can think of the most wicked woman in Scripture, or at least the most wicked queen in Scripture, who are we talking about? That'd be Jezebabes. Jezebel. Yeah, Athaliah is related to her. So, and it must have been a lot of people killed here, because they missed Joash. It must have been such an orgy of blood. And sometimes these kings had, sometimes they had 60, 70 children. In an orgy of blood, they killed all the children that had a right to the kingship, but they missed Joash. There must have been a lot of killing going on. He was hidden, verse 12, from them in the house of God for 6 years while Athaliah reigned over the land. We're not told anything about her reigning over the land, but she was established for 6 years, and it must have been a bloody time. Now, what do you think about this guy Jehoiada? How does he fit into your Romans 13 idea? In the seventh year, this is chapter 23, Jehoiada strengthened himself and made a covenant with the captains of hundreds, Azariah, and there's a lot of names there, and basically what happens, we won't read it, you can, they go through the actual plot there, and it was quite a plot. It was a conspiracy, is what it was. And Jehoiada, the priest, winds up getting Athaliah, this wicked woman, killed. Killed. Okay? And he sets up Joash, who was the rightful king, on the throne. Question. Athaliah, queen for 6 years, murdering woman. God ordained? How's that all work? And if she is God ordained, what's Jehoiada doing? Jehoiada gets her killed. He puts Joash on the throne, and we're told in the scriptures that as long as Jehoiada was alive, he lived to be 130 years old, Joash was a good king. And when you read the passage here in 2 Chronicles and also in Kings, you will see that the Bible is very, very gracious towards Jehoiada. Can't say enough good things about the man, but not so with Athaliah. In fact, chapter 24 and verse 7 of 2 Chronicles, we have the inspired description of this woman, Athaliah. Here it is. For the sons of Athaliah, that wicked woman had broken into the house of God and had presented the dedicated things of the house of the Lord to the Baals. So even the chronicler himself tells us that she was a wicked woman. Now, do we have an example, that was my question, of a righteous uprising against a civil magistrate? And the answer is once again, yes. And right here it is. So whatever your interpretation of Romans 13 is, you have to fit this into it. But we're not finished. Now we're to the part where you've all been waiting for. Yeah, buddy. That Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. Yeah. Yeah, for those of you that haven't followed it, don't blame you, first of all. But it looks like some very tolerant types from Antifa and the BLM, Black Lives Matter movement. Oh, that to me is a little more, that's a little more fuzzy to me, what's happening there. But the Antifa thing is not fuzzy to me. Yeah, they have managed to take over a section of Seattle, Washington, 6-7 blocks or whatever, and declared it CHAZ, the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. You need to know that the police have abandoned the area and that they have the support of the local mayor. She keeps defending them. They've set up the zone and they are defending it with weapons, and they have a little sign. Has anybody seen it? When you go into their little zone, have you seen the sign? You are now leaving the USA. Have you seen that? Picture of that. You are now leaving the USA. Right? So you all know where I'm going with this. How's that Romans 13 working for you now? If you live in that zone. Police have abandoned the place. Mayor supports it. President Trump doesn't. Remember one of the questions we asked at the very beginning of our study? Remember this question? What do you do when there's conflicting commands or demands from the civil magistrates? Now what? Well, you might want to bring a little money along with you. Here you go. Ready for this? From a writer named Tyler Durden from ZeroHedge.com. What do you think of this? Seattle's so-called Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, CHAZ, has begun reparations as white members of the fledgling sovereignty were asked on Friday night, two nights ago, to give at least one black person $10 before leaving the area. How's that Romans 13 working for you? So there's this guy in a mic, right? And I watched it myself, and I've got a quote here, and this quote is accurate. He says this, he says, "I want you to find, by the time you leave this autonomous zone, I want you to give $10 to one African-American person from this autonomous zone. And if you find that's difficult, if you find it's hard for you to give $10 to people of color, to black people especially, you have to think really critically about, in the future, are you going to actually give up power and land and capital when you have it? If you have a hard time giving up $10, now this is where you got to kind of like this guy a little bit. Because he knows how to talk to people. He knows his audience. Okay, listen to this. If you have a hard time giving up $10, you have to think about, are you really down with this struggle? I just wish I could talk like that all the time. Are you really down with this struggle? If you're down with the struggle, it's going to cost you $10. Are you really down with the movement? Because if that is a challenge for you, I'm not sure if you're in the right place. I think I can answer that one. So find an African-American person. White people, I see you. I see every one of you and I remember your faces. You find that African-American person and give them $10. Cash up, Venmo. I don't know, Venmo, is that like a cash machine? Like, it's an app? Okay. Crank up the app on your... I guess the old app still work in the CHAZ zone. Whatever, $10 in your pocket. That's my challenge to you. Do it. So, I told you today that I'd be asking a question to you. I always have trouble with the term African-American because there's people of all backgrounds that live in Africa and come from Africa. But anyway... language is not that important to us nowadays. What do you think? And that's my challenge for you today. My two questions. Do we have an example of a believer disobeying a direct command of a civil magistrate? Yeah, absolutely we do. Elijah, flat out disobeying the command of the king. Because the king had no right to command Elijah to do it. The king had no jurisdictional authority. Secondly, do we have an example of a righteous uprising against a civil magistrate? Yeah, we do. We have both. But my third question for you is, what do you do? How does your Romans 13 understanding guide you through if you just happen to be one of those poor people stuck in the CHAZ, the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone? How does Romans 13 inform you on what you're supposed to do? Are you supposed to reach into your pocket and give away $10? Here's the thing. I'm not a prophet, nor the son of a prophet, but I'm pretty sure they're not stopping with $10. Pretty sure. So you better dig a little deeper and deeper. They're already charging, extorting money from businesses to stay open. Of course, we do that all the time, right? We call them licenses. We already do that. So what do you think? And that's my challenge this morning. Next week, we're going to Deuteronomy 17 and 18. And I think those two passages slam the door on this misapplication of Romans 13. Close them entirely. We haven't closed it entirely yet. We will next week, I think. But that's my question for you today. How does your understanding of Romans 13 inform you if you just happen to be stuck, own property, own a house, in Chaz? So we'll start the questions that way. So today, I'm asking you. Obviously, you can ask me any questions as well. But today, I'm asking you. What do you think?